You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, local artists in Milwaukee are collaborating with local kids in preparation for the All City Arts Festival. We'll learn about the event and hear some of the music that was created along the way. First, late spring and early summer can mean extreme weather in the Midwest. We expect some big storms and tornadoes every year, but the really big ones happen a lot less often. In fact, it's been over two decades since Wisconsin has seen a tornado with winds over 200 miles an hour. Does that mean we're due for a big one? Tim Halbach is the warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service office in Milwaukee Sullivan. He's in our studio right now in Madison. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
So we are technically in tornado season right now, right?
Yeah, typically once you start getting into late April, May, you're starting to get at the beginning periods of when we start seeing more tornadoes or severe weather in Wisconsin. June is our peak month for when we've seen the most tornadoes, but really any time of year we can get it if the right conditions come together.
And about how many tornadoes do we get in the course of a average year, if there's such a thing as an average year?
Nothing's really ever average, right? It seems. But actually last year wasn't 23 is what the standard number is that we've used as our average for what we get in Wisconsin. Southern Wisconsin, our area that we forecast for, about 8 to 10 is what is kind of normal for us.
And I imagine you can't say coming into a year, oh, this is going to be a big tornado season, oh, there aren't going to be many. It's just not that kind of predictability.
Yeah, even like a day before, sometimes things can get thrown off by if there's extra cloud cover, things like that. Trying to predict how many severe weather events we're going to have is really hard to do. Really, all it takes is one really bad one for it to set a season as being a bad season for us.
And let's talk about how we measure tornadoes and what constitutes a bad one. We see the used to be F, now it's the EF, 0 through 5. Is that right?
Yeah, I still call it the F, like a kind of a F. zeros, ones, and twos are the most common types of tornadoes. Thankfully, they don't do a whole lot of injuries or fatalities with those. It's fours and fives that we consider to be violent tornadoes. Threes and twos are what we call strong tornadoes. So it's not as frequent that we see those kinds of tornadoes, but when we have a 3, 4, or 5, that accounts for about 3 out of 4 fatalities with any tornadoes that do occur.
How long has it been since we've had some of the most serious tornadoes in Wisconsin?
Well, the last violent tornado that's occurred was the Oakfield tornado back in 96. And before then, we had a number of EF4s and 5s back in the 80s. It was a pretty active period in the 80s for whatever reason. But you got to go back about 22 years before we've had a 4 or 5 in Wisconsin.
Now, that doesn't mean we're due, if I understand the probability here, right? It's not like with each passing year, it gets more likely. The tornado doesn't care what happened last year or the year before.
No, neither does the weather. It's just going to be, no one's ever due to get some kind of weather. It's just that it's been a while, so we get worried about complacency. We have a few forecasters in our office that came from the Springfield, Missouri office and worked the Joplin tornado, and they saw right after that tornado that there was this huge spike in people wanting to learn more about tornadoes and being prepared and all that. But as time goes on, that resiliency and readiness kind of goes down and fades away from memory. So our concern is that the people that, haven't seen a tornado like that in a long time aren't going to be prepared or have the options ready for them for when that day does come that we get that next violent tornado.
Talking about tornadoes with Tim Halbach from the National Weather Service. He's a warning coordination meteorologist there. You mentioned people got into the business in part because they'd seen tornadoes in Joplin. I understand a Wisconsin tornado is part of what led you into your line of work.
Yeah, that's correct. I always knew something was wrong with me from when I was a little kid, going outside to look at storms and watching the Weather Channel all day. But I grew up in Fond du Lac, and when I was 16, watched the Oakfield tornado from my parents' doorstep, basically.
You literally saw the tornado
in
the distance, I hope?
Yes. It didn't hit our house or anything like that, but we were about 3 or 4 miles to the north, and I just remember watching it as it was off in the horizon. It just looked like a big cloud that was on the ground. It didn't really match with what I had kind of expected to see with a violent tornado. And then as it came through Oakfield and went just to our south, it started to rope out and go through its dissipating stage. And that's an image in my mind that's kind of been burned into it. And I knew something was kind of wrong with me because my friends had been calling me saying, we're waiting for you to play euchre with us. We need a fourth. And I'm sitting there like, hey, there's a tornado going on. We need to, check this out. So that kind of got me started in meteorology. When I went to UW-Milwaukee, that's where I kind of put that to faith.
And let's talk about now predicting that tornado and how ready we are. And I imagine there's got to be a conflict when you're issuing warnings. You don't want to issue a false warning and make people complacent the next time comes around, but you really don't want to not issue a warning when there's a real deal coming.
Yeah, and that's really, it's, I won't call it a game, but it's difficult for us to balance that because we want to make sure that we hit everything and try to give some kind of heads up that there's a tornado that's coming. But at the same time, we don't want to just toss out a tornado warning for the fun of it. And like you said, kind of develop that false sense of awareness. So that's something that we really weigh in. Even last year with the Madison tornado that happened in October, we got a call from Dane County's Sheriff's Department saying we got reports of damage. Somebody saw the tornado, but they thought it lifted. So we held off on issuing a tornado warning because we didn't want to just toss out a warning, even though that it had happened. Then got a couple more reports, and that prompted us to push it through. So we weigh a lot of that into the warning process and making sure that, you know, people aren't overwarned, but they're also properly warned in time so that they can seek shelter.
And I want to alter a phrase I used. False warning isn't what you'd issue. You are looking at conditions and reports and trying to let people know if there's that risk.
Right. Any warning that we issue is based on something that we're either seeing on radar. There's some rotation there. Our analysis of the environment that we're seeing that there's a favored area where there could be a rotation that develops, or somebody that is on the ground telling us what they're actually seeing. So we put that all together. We get try to piece that together and then get a warning out. Our goal is to get as much lead time as possible to people, but sometimes it's not as quick as we'd hope.
And we've been talking about warnings so far. Can you talk about the difference between a warning and a watch?
Right. So that's really when the whole process works the best, is when we can forecast that something's going to happen. A watch, that gets issued when the conditions are coming together. So you might not even have storms out there yet, but we're starting to see the clouds kind of perk up. And typically about 2 to 6 hours before those storms become severe or possibly start dropping down tornadoes, that's when the watch comes out. A warning means there's a storm there and it's producing the severe weather or is about to. So we get a lot of people that confuse those two terms because they do both start with WA.
And warning is when we should be doing something.
Correct. That's when you should be seeking shelter and, you know, have that all picked out ahead of time rather than in the moment. But a warning, that's when you need to be taking action.
If I can take this behind the scenes, when we're in this state where it looks like, oh, we're in for a night of, often a night, but I guess it could be a day too, of weather. I think about people in your line of work, either the TV meteorologists or the weather service people. You're pulling all-nighters sometimes on these, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we don't leave until the storms have exited, and even sometimes if we've had flooding, we stay late to make sure that the river forecasts are going out properly and that we're getting all the information we need to get. If there has been a tornado, part of my job is typically to go out the first thing the next morning to go and survey the path to kind of to determine how bad the tornado was, what the rating would be for it. But, yeah, we're up there all night until basically the storms are gone. And we always have at least two people that are working anyways.
And I know people, including my parents, over the years who have done tornado spotter training. How much do you rely on the people who do that training?
Heavily. Those are our ground truth. Those are the people that are telling us what's happening. Our radar is a great tool to be able to see where storms are and being able to pick up on that first basically spin that's occurring, but the spotters tell us what's happening on the ground. And when we put that information into our warnings, people take action. They seek shelter. When they hear somebody's actually seen a tornado, they jump on that.
We'll leave it there for now. Tim, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Tim Halbach, warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service office in Milwaukee Sullivan. We talked with him about Wisconsin's recent tornado history. An event coming up this week in Milwaukee shares the work of hundreds of artists and musicians, all of them from local schools.
The idea of it is not only to celebrate the art that the young people have been doing in the schools, but to show that that's only an extension of the larger community of art in the city. So it's no separation between what kids are doing and what adults are doing. It's more so under the banner of this is all the art that's happening in our city.
That was Kieran Vedula, also known as Q the Sun. He's a musician, producer, and youth advocate in Milwaukee. He was talking about the All City Arts Festival, a three-day event running May 9th through 11th on the Summerfest grounds in Milwaukee. The event features collaborations between elementary, middle, and high school students and the local arts community. We'll hear more from Kieran about his experience mentoring those kids. And Anthony Soyak joins us now. He's Milwaukee Public Schools music curriculum specialist and event organizer for the All City Arts Festival. Anthony, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about this arts festival. I had a picture of, you know, a high school gym and a few displays here and there and maybe a stage. No, this thing is huge. Can you talk about the scale of it?
Yes, it's a little bit bigger than that type of event. So this event is actually going to feature over 8,000 students. And like you mentioned, it involves students at the elementary, middle, and high school levels. And they're going to be presenting art forms, including visual arts, music, dance, theater, spoken word, and much more. And in addition to what you mentioned is that we are connecting with the community. So there are schools that are performing. There are also schools that are collaborating with local musicians and with our community arts partners that are going to be doing a wide variety of activities and performances at the festival.
And Milwaukee Public Schools declared this school year, the 17-18 school year, as the Year of the Arts, and this festival is kind of the culmination of that. Can you talk about the Year of the Arts?
Yes, so the Year of the Arts, we wanted to connect our students to meaningful, engaging arts experience in their classroom, schools, and across the city, and that's exemplified in the All-City Arts Festival. And in doing so, we wanted to have our students practice arts integration in the classroom. We wanted to provide our teachers with professional development about how to do arts integration. We started a citywide passport that involves students and families going to different types of events that were centered around arts in the city of Milwaukee. We increased our partnerships across the district, and we wanted to continue our spotlight around our turnaround art schools. And then, of course, this big event, the All City Arts Festival, is really our big finale to the Year of the Arts.
And I want to talk about that collaboration. I want to hear again from Kieran Vedula, who talked to us about this last week. The music you hear in the background as part of this is the result of some of these collaborations between students and area artists.
The most important side of it for me is learning the ability to have confidence in your own voice. Whether that literally means the words that you're saying or just how you present yourself to the world. And that also naturally connects to how you connect and relate to people and are able to kind of move through life and present your ideas. So a lot of our programs that we do, it's all about that self-affirmation and self-confidence, because particularly in the communities that we work in, there's a lot of different types of negativity from the environment, from family, from friends. And so there's that additional boost that's needed to kind of break through. So when you get on stage and you've made a song and then you get to rap it or sing it or dance or whatever in front of the crowd and you get that validation, it not only makes you feel validated as a songwriter or a performer, but it gives you that confidence overall as a person to continue pursuing whatever you may want to pursue in life. That's two. I'm looking at the youth. I'm counting on you. Want to speak a message. I hope it gets through. But she's just a teen. She must have a fever. I really don't believe her. She really think that she could be a leader. Well, last time I talked to Timothy, he said to me, I could do about anything. So bring it on. You know, a lot of our students aren't necessarily trying to become, you know, professional musicians. Some of them want to be doctors or lawyers or real estate agents. And so the arts is what gives that creativity and that confidence to kind of put oneself out there and connect with people. And education, what a wonderful mix to throw in their face. Hold on, we're going to get it together.
So, Anthony, can you, we're Kieran Vedula talking there. Can you talk more about the impact you're hoping that these arts programs have on students from elementary through high school?
Right. Well, you know that I believe in the power of the arts. And, I mean, what Kieran is speaking about there is a great example of that. And we know that the arts are so powerful and they have transformative components that support every student's learning and impact their life. I mean, I know for my own self, I wouldn't be the person I am without music. I mean, being the music curriculum specialist and really speaking about arts, they teach students those life skills and they teach them creativity, persistence, problem solving, and I could go on. But those things are skills that they learn and they keep with them for a lifetime. And really, it's incredible that we could have our students come together around arts and we could allow them to express themselves and demonstrate how smart and how skilled they are through arts.
Talking to Anthony Soyak, Milwaukee Public Schools Music Curriculum Specialist, event organizer for this All-City Arts Festival we're talking about, takes place later this week. Anthony, take us on a tour. If we go to the state fairgrounds and take in some of the festival, tell us some of what we're going to check out there.
Right. This, I have to tell you, even just organizing this event, and when we were looking at the entries that we received from schools, we were excited. Just to see the diversity of our schools, of who was performing and what they were doing, you would see a wide variety. So we see drum lines, we see African world drumming, we see dance, spoken word, concert bands, orchestras. It just goes on and on, and the variety is great. But when you go to the festival, you're going to see that great diversity of our schools. So we're going to be on three different stages at the festival. The three stages are BMO stage, Briggs and Stratton stage, and South Pavilion. But not only are you going to see those wide variety of performances, including vocal and instrumental ensembles, but you'll see dance routines, you'll hear spoken word, and then there's this another level to this. So we have an art gallery that's going to feature more than 30 different schools presenting artwork, and that'll be digital media, and it'll be 2D and 3D art objects. So that'll be really neat. And then on top of that, we wanted to involve our community even more. So we have art activities for students, and that's going to involve a wide range of community partners. Some of them include AWE, Arts at Large, Dance Works, the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music. A number of our partners have stepped up and said, we want to be a part of this. We want to make it a great experience for our students. So a lot of them are going to be providing these arts activities, where students are going to be trying out a variety of arts activities. They're going to be doing a variety of things. And not only is that open to schools, but that's also open to the public. So think how cool it would be. You walk from one stage, you see a dance routine. You walk to the next stage, you see a concert band. You walk to a different stage, you see a choir. And then you could go try out an instrument or try to learn the salsa, or maybe you could do some printmaking while you're there. So it's a total encompassing art experience.
I want to give a listen again to Kieran Vadula. We talked to him last week. Here he's talking about his interactions with the students on some of these collaborations you're talking about.
There's always that moment where the kid first steps up to the microphone, you know, in the recording studio, and, you know, their face turns red or they're flushed. There's a lot of times when some of them just almost want to just put their headphones down and step away. And then something in them is able to break through. And once they actually put it down, it's almost like a switch that goes off.
Paint my life like a pastel. I'ma just do it myself. Came from the Melbourne, right chill. Got the good book on the top shelf. Cooking up heat in the station. I'm about to snap crustaceans. Bucking, I'm proud, so face it. I put it down for my nation.
And we also do a lot of self-affirmations. My partner, Cam, he goes by Lord Freddy. He does a self-affirmation that goes,
repeat after me. I am.
I am.
I can.
I am confident.
I'm intelligent.
I'm more than relevant.
Let's get it.
And we chant that with the kids at the beginning and end of every class to kind of get that energy going. But also in the process, being really sensitive and making it a safe place for ideas and people's feelings, because that's where music, you know, you're bringing your emotions, you're bringing your day-to-day experience to it. So there has to be an environment created where people can feel safe to do that.
I'll find another one realer than you.
And Anthony, are you hoping this has a wider impact on the community? I'm thinking of, you know, being in New Orleans and being at Louis Armstrong Park and seeing the elementary and middle and high school kids in the drum lines showing up in competitions and it being a defining part of the city. Do you think that Milwaukee can be an art community with this kind of thing as the start of it?
Right. Absolutely. I think this being its first type of festival of its kind, It's the first time that we're getting our schools and our arts community together all in one big festival. And I think for us, it's our goal to have this be part of the fabric of Milwaukee, have this be one of those festivals that we all look forward to, have it be something that we could always say, yep, this is the time that we all come together around arts and celebrate not only our students, but also celebrate our musicians and our artists in the city of Milwaukee.
And Anthony, we've talked a lot about the students, but what's been the response from the local art community, the local music community? Are they like, yeah, this is something I want to do. We need this.
Absolutely. I think a lot of times our arts partners are always asking that question, how can we get involved? How can we help? And I mean, just from the response that we've gotten from our arts community, from all those different partners saying, yes, we're here to help, just tell us how, that's great. And having people like Curon and other individuals that say, yeah, I want to be a part of this, and I have some great ideas on how I could come and I could collaborate and we could present. And what we really want to do is say, this is what arts is in Milwaukee. And we've never done that before, and I think that's really exciting, and I'm just really excited to see what it becomes and how it shapes the future.
This is year one, basically, for this All-City Arts Festival at this scale anyway. Are you planning on year two and three and so on?
I hope so, as long as they let me keep doing it.
We'll leave it there. Anthony, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
No, thank you. I really appreciate you giving me some time.
That's Anthony Soyak, Milwaukee Public Schools Music Curriculum Specialist. He's event organizer for the All City Arts Festival. That's a 3-day event running May 9th through the 11th on the Summerfest grounds in Milwaukee. The event features collaborations between elementary, middle, and high school students and the local arts and music scene. The number of dairy farms in Wisconsin shrunk by 500 last year, and about 150 have left the business so far this year. Low milk prices are putting a serious strain on farms with already tight margins. And when farms go out of business, that affects the farmers themselves, of course, and their local communities and economies. John Peck is the executive director of the advocacy group Family Farm Defenders. John, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me here.
And Joel Greeno is with us, the group's board president and a farmer in Kendall. Joel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, John, let's start with you. We hear these numbers, a lot of dairy farms closing. Western Wisconsin leading the country last year in terms of farm bankruptcies. Can you talk about the squeeze that a lot of dairy farmers are finding themselves in right now?
Well, we are having these historic low milk prices right now, which is, for a lot of farmers, are already on the edge. That's like the last thing that will put them over. So, and, you know, that's a combination of things. We have increasing concentration in the dairy industry. So some of the listeners might have heard about we have large factory farms expanding while the small farms are being squeezed out. We also have this whole issue of global trade. So we have unregulated dairy imports, which are providing a lot of cheaper milk from outside the country, putting farmers out of business. And then, of course, we just have all the existing crisis in the rural countrysides. I mean, people have already borrowed a lot of money. They have to pay loans. This time of year, people have just paid their taxes. They know they're not going to be able to make ends meet. So that's why we're getting more suicide calls. We're getting more bankruptcy notices. So it's adding insult to injury to a rural, you know, economic crisis that's been going on for a while.
And Joel, can you talk about some of the difficulties farmers are faced in the dairy industry in particular, if they want to stay in business, but these milk prices are going down? What kind of decisions, what kind of cuts are they having to weigh as they try to stay online?
Well, in a recent conversation, my very own uncle, a farm that's been in the family since 1942, he had dropped all of his insurance on everything because there was no money to pay for insurance. He was cutting every cost, expense he could find and manage to get rid of just to try and keep the farm afloat, and he said it's still not enough. Farmers usually get 2 milk checks a month, and his second one all goes to the bank in loans, so there isn't even any money from that one to work with. So it's a real frustrating situation and hardship for farmers to know that you're trying to function this far below cost of production.
And John, can you talk about the supply of milk? Because we see the number of farms, dairy farms in Wisconsin, is going down. We have, I don't know if glut's the right word, but people are saying an oversupply of milk. What's happening?
Yeah, and I teach economics too. This is a good question for my students each semester. Is like, why could there be an oversupply of milk, low prices, And part of the problem is it's not just a U.S. market, right? So we have milk coming in from outside the country. So the U.S. has been a dairy deficit country for about 20, 30 years now. We use more milk than we produce. It's cheaper to bring in, say, casein from Australia to make pizzas with than buy U.S. milk. So there's that whole angle of the problem. The other thing is there's concentration in the industry. So if you're a big producer, not to mention particular ones on the line, but grassland, dairy, for instance, which dumped 71 farmers last year in Wisconsin, Minnesota, is it easier for them to buy milk from one giant farm or from 75 small farms? So their choice is going to be buying milk from a giant farm. And then in organic, this is also a problem. Like, we often used to think, well, if you're an organic dairy farmer, at least you can make ends meet. Well, that's not true anymore either. I mean, I was at the store yesterday here in Wisconsin just looking at organic milk. All of it was from out of state except for one brand. All the organic milk I found was coming from Texas, Utah, Colorado, Virginia, New York, Indiana, Illinois, Minnesota. There's only one brand from Wisconsin. So, you know, one of our challenges is to the Wisconsin dairy industry. You want to call your stuff Wisconsin cheese? I dare you to make it with Wisconsin milk, because that's what's going to save our farmers here.
Joel, can you talk about the impact? Obviously, this has an impact on the farmers. We've been talking about that. Can you talk about rural communities if dairy farms and other farms, for that matter, are going out of business?
Well, you know, the economic impact of losing farms. I mean, here where my family's farmed since 1872 in Monroe County, there used to be 792 dairy farms in roughly 1990. And right now, you know, there's maybe a couple of hundred of those left, and our rural communities suffer because of that. I mean, you don't have the families and the farms that supported our small communities, because you don't see people going from the big towns and leaving Walmart to shop at the grocery store in Kendall. It just doesn't happen. And you walk down Main Street Kendall right now, and, you know, I used to go to Charmaine Reardon's drugstore and clothing store, and you know, it's long since been closed, and that was a family I knew. I went to school with their children, and it's a business that no longer exists. And, you know, it doesn't matter if it's that or the grocery store or the barber shop or the lumber yard or all the other businesses, they're all closed. And that's a devastating loss, and it shouldn't be that way. But when we lose farms and farm families that supported our communities, all of our businesses and our friends and our families suffer because of it.
Talking to Joel Greeno and John Peck from the group Family Farm Defenders, looking at the declining number of dairy farms in Wisconsin, some big drops, picking up the decline in the last couple of years with very low milk prices. Even as dairy production, the amount of milk out there on the market has gone up over the years. John, can you talk a little bit more about what small towns, what small communities are losing when they lose that the farming economy and the farming culture?
Yeah, well, I mean, I grew up in a small town as well. I actually grew up in a farm in Minnesota, so we used to have 12 dairy farms in my township. Now I think we're down to four. So, I mean, the impact on the community is, like Joel mentioned, you have boarded up small towns, you have schools. Well, my school is already consolidated, but you have school districts suffering. You know, sort of the Wendell Berry, you know, depopulation of the countryside, right? Unsettling of America problem. And, you know, churches lose membership. You know, you have to drive to get anywhere, as Joel said. I mean, some of the biggest food deserts in our country are actually in rural areas because there's no more local stores. People drive, you know, 30, 40 miles to get to a big box retail outlet. So, I mean, that becomes a problem as far as like the multiplier effect. I mean, I often talk about this with my students. Like, if you spend a dollar with a local farmer, 90 cents of that's going to stay in your area. But if you spend that money with a big farm, like over half that money is going to leave your community because they don't need to buy stuff there. They're so big, they're going to be buying from far, far away. So that, you know, the idea of there's actually a great sucking sound from our rural communities of resources leaving, economies pulling resources out. And we even see that with the banks, you know, banks closing, the money going to Wall Street. And so, I mean, it has a huge ripple effect across the rural economy.
And Joel, I understand this story is personal for you. You still are farming, but you've recently, I understand, decided to get out of dairy?
I did. You know, after 20, I grew up on a dairy farm. I've always milked cows and, you know, went through the hardship of seeing my parents leave the dairy industry. So in 93, I moved my herd and a milking system in just a couple of weeks from their farm to my farm, and that was in 1993, and then just recently sold it just because, you know, you no longer could make ends meet. And I had been in the hospital for a few weeks and had a couple of months of recovery from surgery I had. And when I come back and started taking over, you know, chores again on my own, you just realize that there was no way to make ends meet. And, you know, I remember the day that the trucks backed in and loaded out my cows, and one of the drivers looked at my daughter and said, "You're sad today, aren't you?" And she shrugged her shoulders, and he said, "You know how I know?" And she shrugged her shoulders again, and he said, "I can tell by the tears in your eyes." And with that, my daughter's lost it, and all the rest of the family lost it. And, you know, when you know all your cows and cattle by name, it's hard to load them on a truck and watch those trucks leave and go down the road and knowing you're never going to see your cows again and not knowing where they're going to end up. And, you know, the same day that my cows sold at auction, I started the job to keep my farm going at Ocean Spray Cranberries. And it's hard to adjust, and it's something you don't want to see happen, but yet you see it to yourself and your friends and family and neighbors, and it's something that continues to happen. And as John had said, there's no call for it. We just need some intervention by the people that have the power to do it and not rely on the imports and things that come in that affect our markets and put our farmers out of business.
Talking to Joel Greeno and John Peck from Family Farm Defenders about the decline in the number of dairy farms in the state. A lot of farmers leaving the business over the last couple of years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story or a story in your community? What are some of the biggest struggles you're dealing with if you're a dairy farmer yourself? If you're in one of these rural communities, are you seeing local farms closing down? What is that doing to your local economy, to your local culture? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We continue our conversation about the loss of Wisconsin dairy farms, a lot of them closing over the last couple of years, what that means for our state, for the communities those farms are part of, and for the farmers themselves. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think something needs to be done to help dairy farms, especially these smaller ones that are closing a lot over the last couple of years? Are you a dairy farmer yourself? Were you recently? Call 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Owen is with us in Wauwega. Owen, hi.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for taking the call this afternoon. Hello there, Mr. Peck. I just wanted to share my story a little bit. I'm a dairy farmer. I work on a larger farm. I'm employed by someone else. I'm trying to get my own milk market. It's really hard to find a milk market, but in the same token, the farm down the road is adding on 1,500 more cows, and that's a big dairy with investors, and some of the investors aren't even from this country. They're not even citizens of the United States, which is okay, whatever, but the problem is we're replacing the farmer who can vote with illegal immigrant labor, can't vote, who would like to vote, and are great people, and they call themselves Americans. They think, and they should be American, but because they're not awarded the same rights as the Constitution awards American citizens, we have basically silenced ourselves as a community of dairy farm people because we do not have eligible voters milking the cows anymore.
Owen, thanks for the call. John, Owen brought up a lot there. Let's we haven't talked about the immigrant labor issue as part of this. How does this all fit in?
Right. So, Owen's perfectly right. We now have about 16,000 dairy farm workers in the state, many of which are from other countries. Some of them are undocumented, others are not. And he's quite right. I mean, we would not have a dairy industry in the state right now without immigrant help with workers. I mean, it's hard work on a dairy farm. Ask anyone who's grown up on one. It's a lot of hard work. And so if you can't find people and you're not paying, you can't pay decent wages. I mean, that's part of what our organization would argue is that everyone in the food system deserves a fair wage. Farmers should get a fair price for their milk. Workers should get a living wage working on those farms. But part of the problem is if you're being squeezed by the dairy industry, which I would argue is a big problem, they want the cheapest milk possible. If that means having it all coming from one giant confined animal feeding operation or factory farm, we would say that's the model they want. And our group would argue that we want more farmers in the state, not less, more dairy farms, not less. And having 100 small dairy farms versus one giant one is going to be much better for economy and will create more jobs in the long run, too. I mean, I would hope that many of these, and I know many of these dairy farm workers who've come here from Mexico and other places, many of them were farmers in Mexico and want to become farmers themselves here. Couldn't we provide them that opportunity? But that's not going to be available to them if we have just one or two giant factory farms producing all of our milk.
Thanks for that call, Owen. We'll go next to Megan in East Troy. Megan, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the call.
What did you want to bring up, Megan?
So my husband and I actually took over a farm, and in 2015, we purchased our own herd. And for the last decade, we've been moving towards getting our own herd. And we are young farmers in general, and the average age dairy farmer is 59. And we just lost our dairy contract because we were too small. They actually encouraged us to double our herd size to 60 cows. We were milking about 35 in general. And we couldn't find the funding to be able to purchase the cows in general. So it was not worth the time to come pick up our milk for the amount of cows that we had. So now we are without a milk contract.
Well, Megan, good luck to you in finding that contract. And that, Joel, is a story we hear. We've been hearing a lot. A group of farms lose that dairy contract where even with that contract, they were maybe not even breaking even without. It's a bigger problem. Is this a struggle, especially for those smaller farms like Megan's?
Oh, it definitely is. Just in the paper last week here, it told about 11 farms in eastern Wisconsin that was cut loose by a company that was owned by the fourth largest dairy processor in the world out of Holland. And how is 11 small family farms going to make a dent when you're the fourth largest global dairy producer in the world? You know, it's just a mechanism to further promote the big factory farms and put the squeeze on real people and real families that want to make a living milking cows. And it's just a crying shame that this is allowed to continue.
Thanks a lot for that call, Megan. We'll go next to Mike in Edgerton. Mike, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. What I was going to get to was the issue of if we... the governor should get involved in this because dairy is a big thing for, you know, Wisconsin as well as the cheese industry. And the other thing is, why can't we get all these people like in Milwaukee and certain communities that need food and issues around that and milk? Why can't we get somehow make some kind of scenario where we have a processing plant to be in Wisconsin instead of Illinois, where they can process the milk for the kids that don't have a daily, won't be able to afford milk or anything else. And that could help the dairy industry as well as help our kids have meals or anything like that.
Mike, thanks for the call. So, John, he's looking for a couple different kinds of state government intervention there.
Yeah, I mean, I remember growing up, we used to have little glass milk bottles at my school lunch from the local creamery down the road. That's no longer the case now. If you go to high school in Madison, that milk's coming from Illinois. And other states have tried to have programs where if you live in, say, Vermont, you actually drink Vermont milk as a Vermont child, but that's illegal under current interstate commerce law. So we have some federal things which come into play. One thing where the state could make a difference is, a lot of people may not know, but farmers are taxed on their milk check. It's called the dairy checkoff. So every 100 pounds worth of milk they sell, 10 cents of that goes into a fund for these gut milk promotion programs and so on. And right now that money is being used to promote any type of dairy product. And we would like to challenge the governor and DATCAP, the Department of Agriculture here. If that money is being taken from Wisconsin farmers' milk checks, maybe that money should be going to promoting Wisconsin dairy products and not being used just for generic marketing of milk, because then we're just giving away the money to any big dairy processor. We should be using that to support our local farmers. And there's lots of other examples. I mean, we used to have programs where if you were a small farmer, like our previous caller, you could actually easily get money from the state to, say, buy fencing to help rotate your cows and so on. Now, if you want to get money from the state, you pretty much have to be a big operation. You have to be expanding your herd in confinement. And that's where all the money is. So the subsidies are going for expansion, not for sustainable small-scale production. And we really need to change that trend.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Cindy in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. You kind of answered some of my questions, but I know that we're not losing small dairy farms. And I mean, we're not losing the large dairy farms. It's the small dairy farms, and they're being run out by the CAFOs. And I just wish there was somebody in the state of Wisconsin that would represent the smaller farm instead of the larger farms, because that is, I think, what's doing all of you in.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Joel, do you agree with what Cindy's saying, the balance is for the bigger farms? And if so, what do you do about that?
You know, it's interesting. We just had a caller state that a farm he worked at was going to add 1,500 cows. Well, where do those 1,500 cows come from? There is not a magic new cow store. The only way you add more cows is you have to buy somebody else's cows. And sadly, all those cows for expansions are coming out of, you know, the sale of our small farms. And as those producers let their cattle go, they more often end up just another cow on a feedlot in a CAFO. And it's a trend that really needs to stop, because nowhere in the economy does the farm dollar turn over more than in the farm economy, because not only are those people raising families and paying bills to raise a family, they're also buying the equipment and supplies that it takes to run a farm. And it's been known for a long time that that farm dollar turns over 7 times in the economy. Well, as another caller stated, that when you have these large CAFOs with foreign investors and foreign money and doing outside banking, we know that none of that money is being locally sourced, that they're not doing local business. And so, again, our small communities suffer as a result. And, again, our politicians are promoting this. And if they really care about our state, they need to really put their foot down and create change that is going to keep small family farms on the land, that is going to protect and preserve the economy of this state.
And I want to jump in, John, just briefly, as we run out of time, one change you'd like to see in policy that would help do that.
We'd like to see supply management like they have in Canada. So in Canada, consumers pay less for milk, farmers get more money for their milk. We could do that system here.
John, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
Thank you.
And Joel, thanks for joining us.
Hey, glad to be here.
We've been talking with Joel Greeno, board president of the Family Farm Defenders, longtime farmer in Kendall, Wisconsin, and John Peck is executive director of Family Farm Defenders. We're talking about the issues facing dairy farmers in Wisconsin and what the loss of especially those smaller dairy farms means for communities around the state. You can still share your story. Email us ideas@wpr.org.